Layer?
Not today.
Yeah, is that what we're calling now? Just the extra, the icing?
The icing, yes, icing.
The House Committee on Revenue for May 26, 2009 will come to order. Good morning. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3405, which we had carried over from Friday. And I think the first thing we need to do is hear from Mr. Warner on some of the questions that were raised by the committee last week. And then we'll hear from the department and then continue public testimony.
Mr. Chair, this is just a follow-up to some of the issues that committee members raised last Friday. And I have a couple of things in your packet. By the way, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. And the first is a study you're familiar with, and I've given you this a number of times, but I do think it's a reasonably reliable measure of comparison of the states on business taxes. It's from the it's two-sided. It's Table 6 and Table 7 from the Council of State Taxation Business Tax Study of all 50 states, and it's actually done by Ernst & Young on an annual basis. And I would just the question was in terms of how the proposal might affect Oregon's overall competitive position. And I think you've had a lot of discussion around what are the factors that go into determining a state's relative competitive position in terms of attracting labor and capital. But this focuses on that one element of that, which is the taxation issue, and recognizing that other factors are very important as well. But I refer you to Table 6, which is on one side, shows you the taxes that are considered business taxes by the Ernst & Young study. And you can see Oregon's on Table 6 sum up to about $5.1 billion of total taxes. And the purpose for this is to point out that business taxes go far beyond simply corporate income. There are a large number of taxes that are paid directly by business. The biggest is property tax. The second largest is sales tax on a national basis. So that gives you some context to show you what those business taxes are. And then on the other side of that page is business taxes as a share of overall state and local taxes, and more importantly, I think from the competitive position perspective, is as a percentage of private sector GSP, means gross state product. This is an annual estimate put out by the Department of Commerce for all of 50 states. And you can see if you look at Oregon down below, or down about two-thirds of the way down there, it's that $5.1 billion works out to about 3.7% of private sector gross state product. It is one of the lowest among the states, and I've just penciled in the impact of the proposal, which would be the corporate minimum plus the corporate rate increase that are contained in the amended version of 3405. And you can see that would raise Oregon to about $5.22 billion for the 07-08 year, assuming everybody stays the same, and that would put us at about 3.76%, or rounded about 3.8%. So the bottom line, at least in terms of this narrow measure of tax, business tax burden as a measure of competitiveness, the proposal would not have a major effect relative to other states if they maintain their same policies. So that was the purpose of that, to try to help address that question and give you some actual numbers that that can look at that. The second piece I have for you is a question came up about the rate increase contained in 3405. And as you recall, the proposal, you now do have a dash 3 amendment that spells that out for you. The rate increase would go from 6.6% to 8.2% for a net corporate income above $250,000, so it would be a new marginal rate. And what I've done is print out for you the Federation of Tax Administrators table showing tax rates for corporate income taxes, and that gives us an idea of how Oregon would place relative to other states. You can see it would put us in the upper third or so, or upper quarter And comparing to some other states, for example, Idaho, which is now, I think that question came up, Idaho is at 7.6%, so the 8.2% would put us above Idaho. California is at 8.84%, so the 8.2% contained in 3405 would still be about 0.6 of a percent less than California. Of course, Washington and Nevada don't appear on this table because they don't have corporate income taxes. So those are my efforts to address some of the questions that you raised on Friday.
Any other questions this morning? Thank you.
Okay.
Let's hear from the department.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Katie Lawley, also with the department. And we're here primarily to answer questions, but we have had a few questions ourselves about what is meant by the use of the word sales in the Dash 1 amendment and also in the Dash 3 amendment. As we understand, the intent of this is for corporations that apportion income to mimic the numerator of the sales factor in defining Oregon sales. For corporations that don't apportion income, so you have corporations whose sole business activity is in Oregon, it's also designed to mimic what they would be reporting as Oregon sales if they were apportioning companies. So some examples. A simple example, if you assume that a jewelry store, for example, is formed as a C corporation, what does that corporation report as sales? The business buys inventory and resells it at an increased price. That gross amount of sales would be included in the sales for this bill. Assume that the jeweler also manufactures their own product. They're a goldsmith, and they buy raw materials and make product and sell those. The sales price would be in sales. Also assume that a person walks into the jewelry store with an antique ring and asks the jeweler to sell that product on consignment. The jeweler doesn't actually purchase the product. It sells it on consignment. What would be included in sales is whatever fee the jeweler charges to do that service, not the sales price of the consigned product. And I think that's where there might be some confusion. So when you have a corporation that acts as agent for someone else. Another example would be a real estate agent or real estate broker who sells property. That real estate broker doesn't properly include the sales price of the product in their own income. They record their commission or whatever fee they receive for performing that service. Insurance agents would be another example of someone who sells a policy but doesn't include the sales price of the policy or the premium received in income of the insurance agent. What they include in income is their commission or the fee they receive for performing that service. So those are some simple examples of how corporations only operating in Oregon should calculate the total sales under this proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Try to answer questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Deborah, I'm looking at the Dash 3s. Where is that spelled out in statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, on line 16 of the Dash 3 amendment, it references as determined for purposes of ORS 314.865.
Okay, so that's the statute that I need to look at. That describes what you just described verbally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, this is the statute that references the numerator of the sales factor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I think that a number of people have approached me in the last several days asking me about this particular question. I appreciate having it cleared up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's continue with the public hearing with Lana Butterfield. Is Rich Kingsley also here? Please come forward. And Roger Beyer.
Yeah, it's on these charts, but it doesn't really, isn't very clear as mud. Here, you got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, and Rich Kingsley is an independent agent from Staten, Oregon. He's here to answer questions that I might not be able to answer. We sell insurance for more than one company. Independent agents do. We're a statewide trade association. We might have 10 to 100 different companies in our stable, and we can sell to what the customer needs. And so we were one of the people asking the question, what does total sales mean? Does it mean the premium, or does it mean the commission? And if it was premium, then we were getting very nervous about this. I want to thank Chris Alanak and Deborah Buchanan for meeting with me on Friday afternoon and explaining some of this. But as Representative Berger asked, the words total sales are not clear until you start asking those questions. And when I said, well, you know, some of the agents are probably going to be filing this wrong, Deborah's answer was a good one. She said, perhaps the Oregon Department of Revenue needs to write some very clear instructions for our industry and some rules around this so that our agents who are not used to apportioning income will have clear direction. When we sent this out to some agent CPAs on Friday, which it was hard to get some of them in town, but one of them came forward and said, you know, S corporations, it looks like they're trying to tax S corporations the same as C corporations. My understanding, I think he just wasn't, you know, clear on how to read a bill. My understanding is that that's not true. Our opposition to the bill then centers on the changes to C corporations. Our members run the gamut. I mean, we have a lot of sole proprietors. We have mostly S corporations, but we do have some C corporations, and so I want to speak up for them. For those who are structured as a C corporation, the increase seems to be something that will lead to some constraints on the agency and its employees. Agencies work with both employees and independent contractors. And part of the problem with the gross receipts tax has to do with multiple taxes on the same product. And so insurance companies pay a lot of money already to the state fund. I didn't have time to look up what that is. But then you've got the insurance agencies, and then you've got, you know, the independent contractors who might also be structured as a corporation. Independent insurance agents have no ability to pass the increased tax along to their client because they absolutely do not set the price of their product, and indeed they have little say in the percentage of their commission, and in fact their commission has been going down over the years. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Independent Agents and Brokers of Oregon and also the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Both groups are predominantly independent agents, just as described by Lana Butterfield, and work in the same manner where they are paid a commission, normally a very small percentage of the premium they sell. If the total sales, as written in this bill, includes that total premium, this would be a very huge hit for them. We understand that's being clarified. I also met with Lana and the department and Chris from your staff on Friday afternoon to have some of those questions answered. Made us feel a little better. But I think the key still is here. There are certain types of corporations, and you know, currently those agencies, independent agencies that are structured as a C corp, in corporations you have two different types of businesses, and one type is not able to pass on their costs, and those are price takers. Insurance agencies, independent insurance agencies, fall into that category. They are price takers. They have no say in determining what they will get for their product that they are providing. other corporations, mostly large C corporations, that have ability to pass on costs. So if you raise a cost on them, they can simply pass it on to their customers. But when you talk about independent insurance agents, they have no ability to do that because they are told what they will see for the product or the service they provide. So a bill like this, an idea of a gross receipts tax or a gross sales tax, however you want to describe it, is a double whammy to them because they are taking a hit on one end and not being able to do anything about it on the other end. They also are the people in your local communities. They provide bricks and mortar. They are the face of the insurance companies in your small towns. They are paying the property taxes. They are paying the license and business fees. They are paying road taxes. They are hiring employees. They are paying payroll taxes. So to say that they are not paying their share as corporations is completely unwarranted because they are the ones paying all, supporting these local communities, especially the small towns around Oregon, because they are the face of the large companies. You don't see offices for Safeco and Liberty and those kind of insurance companies in the small communities in Oregon. You see the local independent insurance agent who is the face of those companies. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committees, this bill, this idea of a gross receipts tax hits them specifically harder than you may understand. And so we appreciate the fact that it will be clarified that total sales does not include premium but just commission. But keep in mind the effect even that will have on these small local businesses in your communities. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel? What percentage of your agents gross more than $500,000 a year using this definition of fees only?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Rich Kingsley answer that. I think you can answer it.
Be a small percentage. Oh, sorry. I'm Rich Kingsley, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think it would be a small committee of the independent agents that I deal with and that I'm familiar with. $500,000 would probably be, I'm guessing, maybe 10 to 15% of the agents in Oregon.
And most of those have multiple employees or people working for them. The small independent, the storefront with a couple of an agent or two and a secretary would probably not gross $500,000 a year under this definition of sales, would they?
Say that again.
We're talking only about fees, the fees they receive.
Oh, okay. Well, the percentage, I'm sorry, I was thinking probably be closer to about 50% would make over $500,000.
Okay. So you misunderstood the question the first time around.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the independent agents, I would have to say those in the larger towns probably are typically larger independent agent associations, multiple employees in the same shop. They certainly would. Mm-hmm. Those, when you get into the very small communities, probably would not reach that level. But without going through, I don't know for sure. I mean, that would be, I think, a very small independent agent that did not receive a $500,000 in commissions.
Yes.
Our agents are very well paid, if that's the case. Is a single-man office grossing $500,000 in fees would be doing very well.
A single-man office could not do $500,000.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't think
We barely go over that, and we've got 7 employees.
Yes. Thank you very much. The reason I asked the question, of course, is because we structured this proposal specifically to exclude the very small offices. That was the object of it, and it sounds as though even in your field we've succeeded in that. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Jim Webb, Jim Welsh. Jim, you write your name very clearly, and I still didn't read it right. Jenna, it looks like Calza. And we'll take those two. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and committee members. Jim Welsh with Oregon, with the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. And you can probably anticipate that we would not be in favor of a gross receipts tax. And for all the, a lot of the reasons that we've been listening to here when you had a hearing on this bill, and we would reiterate the problems that it would create. And so I, using a document as my support, one that you're all pretty familiar with, is Oregon Economic and Revenue Forecast Summary. Things aren't going very well out there, and some of my other clients are basically from rural Oregon, all throughout the state. And so, you know, a gross receipts, and let's look at maybe a farm or a ranch who do a tremendous amount of business. They put a lot of things on the books before they have a harvest, before they'll even have any kind of sales. And it's a long time that they have to pay probably some fees on that, or interest on those dollars, and before they realize something. And many times, by the time they get to, say, a beef to market or anything else, you know, it's so marginal, Mr. Chair, that something like gross receipts, by the time they do sell, there isn't any profit in there. They're hoping they have enough to continue to live on and to do business and get feeder calves and continue. There's a lot of other businesses in this state that are in the same situation. And this proposal, Mr. Chair, that could probably be better suited for interim discussion. I don't think it's necessarily a tax fairness discussion at this point in time, when we're all up against the wall. And I think that the Taxpayer Association of Oregon would like you to do what the rest of us are doing, and that's tighten our belts and make our way through another year. Look towards the end of this year and see what the economy is going to be doing, and hopefully it's going to be improving. But even in your report, revenue forecast said at end of 2010 we might not even be seeing some improvements in our economy, and we all know that's a long ways out. Those of us that have enough gray hair that lived through the 80s recession, early 80s recession, realize that just hanging on was really a blessing if you could. There's no doubt about it. And we would like you to just do what the rest of us are doing, and let's just tighten up a little bit and see where we get to before the 2011 session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza, and I'm with the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB here in Oregon, we have over 7,000 members. My average member has about 7 employees or less, so truly the small business in Oregon. We're made up of both C corporations and S corporations. I do not have the percentage breakdown of how much. Nationally, we have more C corporations than S corporations, but I would think that would be opposite here in Oregon. But that being said, I've heard from both C and S corporations over the weekend. My members have actually discussed the corporate minimum at length. They agree that it's probably out of date. However, we do not we don't support the current amendments. We have established 3 principles, though, that we could support with the corporate minimum, and I'd like to kind of go through those with you today. The first being that the corporate minimum should only apply to C corporations. Any minimum added to S corps or LLCs would be in addition to an already high tax rate that they pay. The second principle that my board's established is that any increase that increases the minimum should not change the calculation of the tax through a gross receipts tax or business activity tax. I've had multiple members call me over the weekend who are extremely concerned with the gross receipts tax idea. Like my colleague, Mr. Welsh, was going through, we do not believe that gross receipts is a good way to determine the size of a company. This type of tax does not take into account companies who have high gross receipts and a low margin of profit, which are what many of my members who contacted me over the weekend are concerned with. And the third principle is that any discussion about a corporate tax package should be part of a larger discussion, and we should also be talking about sunsets and temporary tax increases, especially in this economy. My members oppose the proposed new taxes in House Bill 3405. We urge that you take in consideration the small businesses here in Oregon who are struggling to get by, and we would ask them if this conversation needs to be had, that it would be had in the interim, and that we would be asked to come to the table and actually look at how small businesses are doing business and how taxes like this actually damage them, even if they do only have a couple employees. Many of them do gross over $500 million in gross receipts, but don't have that high of a margin of profit. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? I do recall that in the 80s there was a significant tax increase to help tide people over, the government over during that period. It was proposed by a Republican governor. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Let's hear from Kelsey Wilson and Paul Romain. And then behind them we have Jody Weiser.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Wilson, and I am representing Alaska Air Group. If the airlines are covered under this bill, then Alaska and Horizon's tax exposure in the state will significantly increase, and an increase does not support our efforts to expand or grow the PDX market, but runs counter to it, especially in the current economic environment. Alaska Air Group currently pays over $4.6 million in fuel and property taxes to the state of Oregon, and our gross receipts are over $250 million for each Alaska and Horizon, so the new tax burden would be $120,000 for Alaska Air Group.
Well, now you're aware that there's a cap in the bill.
Right, okay. But for each, the cap is 60, correct?
I see.
So for
two
each
businesses,
Alaska
okay.
and Horizon,
I got it.
We would each pay the $60,000. We urge you to reconsider the proposal, and we oppose the current proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association, and we too oppose the measure. Just give you, by way of example, a rural gas station, small gas station, pumps about 50,000 gallons per month, and that is a small station. That tax on that station at what we're paying right now, which is about $2.50 a gallon, goes from $10 up to $1,600. Now, when you consider that the profit in that station may be somewhere between, say, $2,000 and $7,000, that's a pretty significant chunk of whatever you may be making on that station. The problem with a gross receipts tax is it's totally different than an income tax. The fact that you bring money in does not mean you're making any money. And when you're in a business that has a lot of income and a lot of expenses, small margin, like the grocery business or the fuel business, it's a poor way to calculate. We understand the dilemma, and believe me, we're trying to be part of a solution here, but when you simply look at gross receipts, even with the $500,000 exemption, it doesn't help us, because even a small station is subject to the price fluctuations. You all recall, right now I'm using $2.50. But, you know, depending on which day of the week you happen to drive by a station, you don't know what the price is. And that's really not our fault at the retail level or wholesale level. It's more of a production problem. Our margins pretty much stay the same. In fact, as the prices are going up, we make less money. It's kind of a unique situation. We're actually, people are mad at us when we're making the least amount of money, and happy with us when we're making the most amount of money. When prices fall, we can hold our margins better. The problem now is, at one point, we had over $4 a gallon gas. What does that do when you're making very little net profit? In addition, when the prices go up, our credit card fees go up, because they're a percentage of the sale. So we pay more to process basically the same transaction. So we would ask you to take a look at this. We don't have a solution for you, although raising the income tax rate, when you actually figure what your income is at least for us a far better way to look at it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Romain, just out of curiosity, what proportion of your members pay minimum tax versus an income tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I can't really tell you. A lot of the gas stations, for whatever reason, are C-Corps, which actually surprised me. I figured everybody would be an S-Corp, but there, a lot of them are C-Corps. Nobody is owned, or almost nobody is owned by a major oil company anymore. There's no profit in retail gas, as much as the public thinks that you're making a fortune in this stuff. You can always tell if there's profit in the business. If the major oil companies are in it, there's profit. If there's not in it, there's no profit. But I can't really tell you an answer to that question. Sorry.
That's a major shift from just recently, isn't
yes.
it? What did they do? Did they sell them all off? Or?
Mr. Chair, if you look around the country, the stories you see are, you know, XYZ oil company getting out of the retail gas business. There is no money in retail gas.
So who owns them?
Your local neighbors.
So they're back to small one or two station ownerships, huh?
As the lobbyist for the big oil companies likes to tell me, we achieve divorcement without divorcement.
All right. I have no idea what that means, but maybe I don't need to know either.
It was an attempt when you were a boy to get rid of the majors in the business, require, in effect, local ownership.
Before I was paying attention.
Before you were paying attention.
Thank you. Anything else? Now that I've put my foot in it completely. Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate your testimony. Jody Weiser.
For the record, Jody Weiser of Tax Fairness, Oregon. Well, this will be a change of tone from the previous testimony. Because I'm going to say, you know, you really need to be bold in what you do here. You heard Friday and you heard today that you really can't create change without people being uncomfortable. There's just no way about it. And it doesn't matter whether that's people on Project Independence or it's businesses. It hurts. Change hurts. And we're looking for a way to hurt fewer people at the Project Independence level, and we need to raise some taxes in order to do that. I think that there are a number of changes on each side of what is proposed that have not gone far enough. $100 is not indexing 10. You would have to raise the minimum to $320 to index $10. So this proposal doesn't go there. It doesn't just do the basic indexing that it seems like any logical proposal would do. Maybe you would want to do it over 2 years, so all those people who are organized as a corporation and their business is no longer operating would pull their corporate structure and not pay a fee to continue on, because there probably are some of the 6,000 that are registered businesses showing no sales that have they're really dead organizations, and so give those organizations a chance to get out of paying more than $100 and clean the books, but then go all the way, index that $10 to $320, and then continue to have it indexed to inflation after that, so that we don't end up where we are 40 terms later when we're trying to face the same issue again. Second, I think I heard on Friday that this the minimum tax would not apply to affiliates, and it seems logical that a tax would apply to affiliates. The owner of SunWest had his name on 700 affiliates. That makes it pretty hard for the bankruptcy courts now to sort everything out, and for our tax system to figure everything out before that. If a business chooses to have affiliates, they are doing that for a business purpose that relies upon the rule of law. And to say, oh, well, if you've got, even if using the Alaska Airlines and Horizon Airlines example, if they don't want to pay $60,000 twice, they can create one corporation instead of two. That's an option that they have to restructure their organization so they don't pay the minimum twice. Corporations receive substantial benefits from states. States substantially finance K-12 and higher education systems, which furnish businesses with a productive workforce. They maintain a legal and regulatory system that provides limited liability for owners, enforces business contracts, and discourages both commercial fraud and personal theft. They provide public transportation networks that enable businesses to obtain inputs and get their products to market and to get their employees to and from work. Since all businesses benefit from services like these, they should share at least a modest amount in the responsibility for financing them. And raising $10 to $100 really doesn't become a modest amount. Whether they have a profitable year or not, and whether they have Oregon sales or not, it must become part of doing business. Landlords, utilities, employers, and suppliers all expect to be paid for what they provide, whether a business has a profit or not. Why not the state? Other taxpayers have every right to expect that C corporations, be they big multinational corporations or little companies, pay for the fact that we provide benefits and we no longer care to do that for $10 a year. House Bill 3405-1 would raise the tax on some massive C corporations by only $140 or $190, depending upon whether the business is an Oregon business or its main offices are in another state. This isn't fair. The services the state provides are significant whether or not the business sells directly to Oregonians. Think of Genentech, Solar World, and most wind farms. They are exporting virtually all of their product. And since we only tax what you sell here, we won't be receiving taxes from them. Yet they, too, will rely upon law, court, roads, and an educated workforce as much as any other corporation. The only thing we are not providing these businesses is customers. Why are they excluded from participation in paying for our state? Today you heard a number of comments about why a gross receipts tax isn't fair. This is another reason it's not fair. This plan does not increase the taxation of those massive businesses in any significant way at all. And the comment about S-corps versus C-corps is equally valid. In fact, Oregon's C-corporation rate under this plan would be only fair it would be somewhat fair for some corporations. But imagine yourself back 2 or 3 years when car companies were making money. I don't know whether Ford and Chrysler have nexus in the state, so I don't know if either one of them actually pays taxes here. But let's pretend we know the answer. We would be charging Chrysler Corporation 9% because it's organized as an LLC. And we would be charging Ford Corporation 6.6, or if their taxable income is high enough, 8.2%. How are these corporations different in our responsibilities to them as a state? They're using the same services. Why would one be benefited over the other because they chose a different tax form? If you think of you're saying that Barnes & Noble under this plan would pay 8.2%, while Annie Bloom's books would pay 9%. Doesn't make sense. Nordstrom would be benefit over Paloma Clothes, Olive Garden over Novak's Hungarian restaurant, the Bank of America over Umpqua Bank, Bird's Eye Foods over Norpac, H&R Block over Jacobson and Ivy, or Whole Foods over the vendors at the farmer's market. From the state's perspective, there is no logic at all in treating these different these businesses differently. So if you equalize the rates and go to a 5, 7, and 9% structure for businesses, all the way to 9, not to 8.2, as is suggested in House Bill 2913, you could give up the whole gross receipts tax idea, raise the minimum to 320 for everybody and index that amount, and create the same kind of revenue you're creating with this plan. It would probably be a fairer plan because it would level the playing field between business types. The new rate would be largely paid by out-of-state corporations because that's who pays in the state, is those who have sales in the state, and it mostly is out-of-state corporations. And it would raise a quarter of a million from those C-Corps that do now pay more than the minimum. It is time for these two significant changes. You need to substantially raise the corporate minimum. And if you're going to have an alternative minimum tax, truly it makes more sense to base it on the payroll kinds of things and the value-added tax than on gross receipts tax. And you should tax C corporations' profits the same as you tax profits from all other business types. It's time to favor Oregon's 185,000 college students, not its 12,000 profitable corporations. It's time to ask more of the 20,000 corporations that do business in Oregon but pay no taxes on Oregon sales, either because they sell little here or they show no profit. Listen not to the business community's voices. They will never agree, so they will always say no, no matter what you propose. Listen rather to what your souls tell you is right. With the co-chair's budget and the Dash 1 or Dash 3 amendments, college students will see a $360 increase. It's a tax increase. It's a tuition and fee increase for college kids. That is more than many, many corporations will pay with the proposals before you today. That's simply not fair. We call on you to be bold and brave in your leadership of our state.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to mention how exciting it was to see Novak's Hungarian restaurant listed on here, and I would urge everyone to prefer that over the Olive Garden. He's a wonderful small business in the Albany area, and I urge you all to visit often.
Mr. Chair. Representative Berger, after that commercial.
You say what they lack in tax advantage, they gain in personal.
Government, it works for you.
Yeah, I have a question of Jody. Jody, I noticed that your organization has a new name, or is this a new organization, or did I miss it that you're now Fair Shared?
Oh, I put the wrong thing up there. We are supporting that campaign, and that campaign would raise the personal income tax and the corporate tax in order to
And that is
hold
a campaign
the,
that,
that... That's a campaign that's kind of separate from Fairness Oregon, but we are definitely aligned with it.
Okay.
But I should have put Tax Fairness Oregon on the corner of this letterhead. You're right.
So Tax Fairness is the name of the organization that...
This is just a campaign for this year that supports the efforts in this building to bring in more revenue.
Is this a PAC?
It's a coalition of organizations that have interest in us having good schools and good services.
So what you should have here is Tax Fairness Oregon.
Yeah,
that
I
still
should.
Exists.
Okay. Yeah, Dennis, thank you. I'm sorry. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jody, the differences in the C-Corps and the LLCs are significant at many levels, and so your suggestion that we equalize the income taxes, it seems to be overlooking a lot of the challenges that go with the C-Corp structure.
Well,
and I just want to comment on those just briefly because I'm very familiar with C-Corps and I've worked with them for many, many years, and I understand, for example, the difficulties in getting out of a C-Corp, that you don't suffer if you're in one of these others, and that of course explains why there's been this dramatic shift to the other devices.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder about this leveling concept you have. It kind of overlooks those other challenges you face in a C corp. Why don't you address that for me?
I think the point is that for the state and what the state offers, there is no difference. It doesn't matter whether it's a Chrysler or a Ford company. The state provides the same services. The business structure that a business has taken on, they have taken on for their own purposes. And so there are small businesses that form as C-Corps for a reason, and it's about liability protection. Am I not right? There's a different kind of liability protection for a C-corporation than there is for an LLC, for instance. And it's that kind of thing that business owners make their decisions on. But that's their decision. That's not our decision. We provide the structures, and maybe we made a mistake in starting to provide the multitude of different structures that we provide. But we provide the structures, and they choose. But in terms of the services that the state provides, what's the difference?
Well, the services are one element that one considers when you form a C corp as opposed to an LLC. I'm tempted to comment upon my conversation with the Chief Justice just several days ago regarding the legal system's budget, and the comment you make in here about the value that system provides to the state. If I were a corporation right now, I might be very concerned about the value of that service because the state isn't funding it adequately. I might be wondering why I'm being asked to pay more for that service when, in fact, it's not being provided, at least according to the Chief Justice, to the degree he would suggest. But I digress. Your question was, what is the difference between the services provided to an LLC as those provided to a C-Corp? And the answer is somewhat different when you look at the tax structure. And so you can't just look at the services, and you cannot. You have to look at all different elements of the structure of the device. And there are many. And so when someone comes into my office and says, should I for a C-Corp or should I for an LLC, we go down a checklist of about 15 issues. Then we call in a CPA, and we walk through all of those elements. So to call this out is to maybe gloss over all of those differences. But in order to answer your question appropriately, I'd have to go get my 22-page checklist and go through it with you.
Yeah.
Probably
yes.
Send you a bill.
But I think depends on which hat you have on today.
In the long run, if an LLC or a C corp goes bankrupt, the state provides a bankruptcy court. It might be a bad bankruptcy court right now because we don't have enough money, and that's what this bill is helping to address, hopefully. But the bankruptcy court is there, and having lived through that process, you know, the debtor who owed us a lot of money had not made the mistake that a lot of car dealers have, and so his personal assets weren't at risk. And, you know, there's doubts about whether those courts actually serve the public well rather than the business well, but it's there. And it's not significant whether an LLC or a C-Corp when you hit that bankruptcy court for the court services side, which is what taxes are supporting.
Yes, Chair. The bankruptcy court is a federal court, not a state court.
Right.
And but I think my remark is only to say this is a complex matter that deserves careful thought, and I appreciate the thinking you've done.
Thank you. One of the you've made the point that no one else has made today that. The point of that, and I think you started with that, was to change hurts and we're trying to hurt as few people as possible. I think that's close to a quote. Of course, the point of taxation is to pay for basic services. We wouldn't have it at all. We wouldn't do it if the government didn't need funds in order to pay for basic services. And that's always the trade-off, isn't it, between taxing people, businesses, on the one side, in order to have funds to pay for services that we need. And I appreciate the fact that you have raised the reality that a civilized society depends upon the ability to pay for those basic services in some form or another. Everything, all of the infrastructure that business depends upon, from the court systems you mentioned to roads and highways and information systems that depend upon property laws being enforced and court systems being available, regulatory systems that allow for debts to be managed and handled efficiently and well. We all assume the way credit card system works. It isn't a given. It works because there's a regulatory system in place that everyone accepts, and that regulatory system only exists because of government. And of course, the basic services the state pays for are vastly more expensive: schools, basic health care, and basic protections. There are the reality of the world is that people grow, change, live through their maturity, become old, and die. And that is an absolute reality. The things we must do if we're going to have a civilization is we must raise our children well, we must educate them, we must care for the old, and we must make sure that jobs are available for those in their productive years. I mean, those are things that we know that are obvious, that no one thinks about because they are the water we swim in. And yet, without the basic services the government provides, none of the benefits of civilization would exist. And I know you didn't say all of that, but I wanted to make that point. Taxes are not enjoyable for those who are paying them, but they're essential. I appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3405. Colleagues, we have a number of Senate bills, some of which we think we may be able to move to process fairly quickly. And so I'm just going to start down that list. And I have managed to lose my agenda already. There it is. And let's start with the public hearing. I'll open this public hearing on Senate Bill 498.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 498... Senate Bill 498, thank you, would prohibit the Department of Revenue from applying an administrative rule that would change any particular of a tax return or report, such as income, expense, or deduction, or credit, if the return or report was timely filed and the particulars of that return or report were treated consistent with administrative rules in effect at that time. It applies to administrative rules adopted or amended by the department on or after the effective date of the act, which takes effect on the 91st day following sine die.
Very good. Questions for Chris? Let's hear from Ken Yates and Valerie Sasaki.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Ken Yates. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Bankers of Oregon. I'll be exceedingly brief this morning since I know you have a long agenda and lots of business to take care of. Senate Bill 498 is a very limited measure that creates some greater taxpayer certainty and fairness when relying on Oregon Department of Revenue administrative rules in effect at the time a taxpayer files a return. The legislation very simply prohibits the department from amending or promulgating a new administrative rule where one is already in place and then applying that new administrative or amended administrative rule retroactively in open tax years. And of course, tax years are often kept open in Oregon for many years due to audit, review, litigation, sometimes 15 or more years. We had one case that was 19 years that the tax year was open. Does nothing else. It preserves the legislature's authority to retroactively authorize taxes retains the department's authority to promulgate new rules where none exist on statutes currently. And it allows the department to promulgate new administrative rules where they currently exist and apply them prospectively. What this bill simply does is give the taxpayer greater certainty, fairness, and reliance when they file a return for a certain year for the rules, in compliance with the rules in effect at the time. And that's really all it does. You'll see an impressive list of organizations. This may be historic for this session, maybe any session, but if you look at the list of organizations, you've got the four major business associations and a number of other organizations that represent significant employment in the state of Oregon in support of this legislation. The Senate passed it 32-0, and I would respectfully ask for your due pass consideration, and thank you for your time this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is it that prompted the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, Vice Chair Pence, the bill was prompted by a court case, and it was the 18 or 19-year-old court case involving U.S. Bancorp, but a number of different businesses have had difficulty with the department in open tax years, which are held for an extraordinary long period of time in an open status, and having new administrative rules retroactively applied to them and having to come up with money that they never planned on because they had relied on the rules in place at the time that they actually filed, not 5, 10, 15 years down the road when a new rule came into effect and was applied retroactively. So it's just a basic certainty and fairness and reliance issue that we're trying to address here.
Please.
Thank you.
Did the case reach some result other than what this bill suggests?
It did. It went to the, as I recall, and Valerie can assist me here on the details, but it ruled for the taxpayer, I believe, in the tax court or appeals court. The Supreme Court overturned that, and so this legislation does correct that Supreme Court decision. The department, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but the department is in agreement with this legislation and feels that it's a good fix and will create greater fairness and certainty for the taxpayer.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, I need to know why the Supreme Court reversed it. What was the thinking by the
court? I'll defer to counsel on that. Valerie Sasaki from Miller & Ash, representing our organization, the State Bar.
Chair Barhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Valerie Sasaki. I'm an attorney with the tax practice at Miller & Ash in Portland, and I'm here primarily on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association in support of our clients' comments just now. With respect to your question on U.S. Bancorp, I can forward you a copy of the case if that would be convenient so that you can read the judicial findings. It was based on the department's longstanding policy that all administrative rules should be applied retroactively in this case. And Oregon has an extraordinarily long potential for that situation, as occurred in that case and in certain other cases, because of the way that the interaction between the federal statute and the state statute and our audit periods can be very long. So you have cases where it can be 18, 19, 20 years after the tax year in question that the taxpayer is asked to come back and, you know, make changes on a return that they filed 20 years ago based on a change in policy or a change in position.
Thank you.
Interesting. What sorts of tax years are held open that long? Are we talking about corporate tax returns? Are we talking about estates? What are we talking about?
Really, I believe it could be any return that's filed, because Oregon's statute is traditionally 3 years, but if you have a federal audit open up your return, then you're going to be held open for the period of the federal audit and a certain period beyond that. So it's true of individuals as well as corporations. I'd like to add one comment.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other hats that I wear is as chair-elect of the Oregon State Bar's Taxation Section, and I'm also a member of the Legislative Liaison Subcommittee for that section. And the section's position has been and is that it's generally supportive of the legislature providing us with guidance in this area in the form of a statutory pronouncement.
Thank you. Other questions? I have one. This bill seems to be silent on the topic of what happens when there is a regulation that covers an area, and then the legislature changes the statute that covers that area. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing in here that seems to address that issue. What is your understanding of what that would be? What the result would be in that situation?
Mr. Chairman,
The reason I ask the question is because the direct language here is that once an administrative rule covers an area, and if it covers an area during the time, apparently during the time a tax return is filed, mm-hmm. then that's it. We're done. And suppose that the legislature changed the law that applies for that period. Mm-hmm. What happens then?
Mr. Chairman, Ken Yates again. The statute would govern. This is in no way impacts the legislature's authority to pass new taxes or even new retroactive taxes. And of course, the department, and we would encourage the department and have encouraged the department to promulgate new rules for a new statute so there is prospective guidance going forward for the taxpayer and greater reliance and certainty and fairness.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Does the department want to be heard on this bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, I would just say that we appreciate the willingness of the sponsors and the proponents to work with us on developing a couple of amendments to the bill. The question did come up about the case that prompted the legislation, and I'll try to explain what happened there just a little bit and hope I get it right. We had a...
Let me interrupt.
Yes, sir.
I think it may be useful for us to review that that court opinion as was suggested. And it's perfectly fine for you to go ahead and summarize it, but I'd like to review it. And it sounds as though Representative Vence wanted to do that as well. I'm also very concerned about this issue that I raised just a moment ago about what would happen whether we're truncating the department's authority to write a new regulation in the event that the legislature adopts a new statute, because the language here is pretty clear. And it doesn't include that as an exception. And so I'm going to ask Ledge Counsel for an opinion about that. But go ahead. If you had some other comments to make, I think the committee would like to hear them.
Mr. Chair, we are also working now on an amendment to our existing administrative rule. And we have published notice of that, and we are having a public hearing July 21, the rule that does provide that all of our rules apply to all open years. So we are working on that and structuring that to provide essentially that legislative rules would apply prospectively, interpretive rules would apply to any period to which a statute applies. So we're trying to draw a distinction that I think is also intended in the legislation before you, that it is indeed not the intent to prohibit the legislature from adopting a statute and having that having the DART department interpret that legislative change. So, for example, you will remember that in 2007 you passed legislation dealing with inheritance tax and provided for relief for certain estates. In 2008, you repealed that retroactively and put in place a new section. So, in the rule, that would be an exception where we would be authorized to write rules that would apply back to 2007 because that's when the legislation applied. So that would be a situation where we could adopt retroactive rules. I think what we're trying to say here is if we have a rule on the books that's legislative in nature, that is, you directed the department to do something by rule, and we adopt a rule, and someone follows that rule, then 2 years later, we won't change the rule and say, well, now you need to go back and redo whatever it was that you did under that prior rule and follow the new rule. That is what I think this legislation is getting to. That's what our administrative rule change is doing. And that's that we believe is what was contemplated here.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on Senate Bill 498? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 498. And we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 609.
Senate Bill 609 allows for the decisions of the magistrate involving protective orders to be appealed to the regular division of the tax court and allows the magistrate to stay the case on merits unless the request for the protective order is resolved. It would require that certain appeals to the regular division of the tax court be expedited and determined within 90 days unless the tax court determines the additional time is needed.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Again, John Marshall representing Associated Oregon Industries. Before you have Senate Bill 609A engrossed, this comes to you unanimously from the Senate, and it relates to the confidentiality of taxpayer business records, tax returns, and documents containing trade secrets during the appeals process. What we're doing with in supporting Senate Bill 609 and having it introduced is to accomplish three things. One, the bill allows either party in an appeal proceeding before a magistrate or the Oregon tax court judge to request a protective order to allow the information introduced either at trial or during pretrial discovery to be covered under that protective order and therefore protected from release to the public. It also allows an appeal of the protective order decision by a magistrate to go first to the regular division of the Oregon Tax Court for that appeal to be determined. Current law requires any appeal of a magistrate to go straight to the Supreme Court, which obviously is very time-consuming and an expensive process, so this creates an additional avenue of appeal. And finally, the bill requires that that appeals of a magistrate's decision before the regular division of the tax court must be determined within 90 days, or additional time may be added if the court determines that additional time is needed. This bill has been negotiated with representatives from the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, the attorneys representing the Department of Revenue over there, as well as the Office of the State Court Administrator, and they've all agreed to these changes. We think it adds fairness to the current appeals process by allowing the taxpayer that's trying to substantiate their appeal to be confident that the documents containing trade secrets, for example, and other confidential documents would not be released to the public, which would do that business harm. And finally, that additional appeals process is much less time-consuming and less costly than going from a magistrate's decision to the Supreme Court. So we would urge your support of Senate Bill 609 as amended, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, given my limited knowledge of this topic.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Marshall? This is the only witness signed up on this bill, so if you have thoughts or concerns about this one, this is the time to ask. As I understand what this bill does initially is that it may change the timing for when the protective order is issued. Right now, the law says that the protective order can be issued Well, in which any proceeding in which confidential business records, tax returns, and documents containing trade secrets should be introduced into evidence. That's the current language. Now, under Oregon law, do discovery statutes apply? Discovery rules apply to this so that these documents could be in the hands of the other party before they're introduced into evidence or before a decision is made about whether they've been introduced into evidence?
Mr. Chair, that's the issue we're resolving.
Okay.
And that is to allow a protective order to be sought for not only strictly mm-hmm. evidence introduced at trial, but also during the pretrial discovery process.
Right. So if I'm the plaintiff and I'm suing a business and I'm asking for documents which contain confidential business records, tax returns, or trade secrets, they can then, under this statute, they could then apply for a protective order at that time before releasing the documents to me, which would require that I keep that information confidential. Is that right, under this proposed statutory change? Instead of waiting until the time I decided that I was going to introduce them in evidence.
Let me see if I can answer it this way. A taxpayer wishes to appeal a decision, let's say relating to the property value.
Okay, this is not involving value. A regular lawsuit, is it?
Right.
It involves only the tax court.
Correct.
Thank you. That narrows it down quite a bit.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And in order to subsist in the pretrial discovery period, that's when both sides are sort of figuring out, one, the taxpayer, how to substantiate their value, the Department of Revenue acting on behalf, well, the Department of Revenue, trying to suggest that the property has a different kind of a value, may request from the taxpayer certain records. And the taxpayers would say, well, those records may involve, say, a production method that would have an effect on the value, but the taxpayer would think, I don't want that to be made public because if that falls into the hands of my competitor, that could do severe damage. So they would say to the magistrate, the Department of Revenue has requested these records that involve very confidential trade secrets, production methods, and we want to make sure that if we give those to the Department of Revenue, that it won't be released to the public. And so the magistrate would issue that protective order, which would build a barrier around those certain documents to make sure that they're not released. Now, this does not have anything to do with the Department of Revenue's ability to share tax returns, for example, with other states. This is just during that appeal proceeding.
Okay. And the proceedings before the magistrate in the tax court are public?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, on the A. Engrossed bill, it says, hearings before the judge or a magistrate of the tax court shall be open to the public. All proceedings shall be reported unless waived by the parties with the consent of the court. So that those documents that are presented to the court are public documents.
And so they can be protected only with a protective order.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make that remark. In situations where we have requested these protective orders, there's lots of opportunity for folks to object to them. So to me, this makes all kinds of sense. And the opportunity to take it to the tax court judge, if you're appearing before a magistrate, instead of having to take it to the Supreme Court, makes all kinds of sense. So this looks like a really good idea. Was there anyone that objected to any part of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, when the bill was before the Senate, in its original form, there were some objections raised, and we worked with the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, the State Court Administrator to resolve those objections. So we're all in agreement now that it makes the changes that we're interested in making.
Were those just as to the means of stating how the appeal would be handled, or was it focused on the broadening of the scope of the protective order?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, it had to do with language relating to, in the original version of the bill, relating to rebuttable presumption, and that just, in conversations with the Department of Revenue, that just didn't work very well. So we made that change, and that language is no longer here.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Marshall? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Could we hear from the department? I'm being excessively cautious, but I'm interested in understanding what the department's position is on this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I would agree with Mr. Marshall's statements that we did have some concerns with the original bill. We appreciate them working with us, and we're fine with the bill as it appears before you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill, Senate Bill 609? And with that, we'll close the public.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to, there's just this irony that's brewing in my head. I think this is a good bill.
Yeah.
I'll support it when we pass it. It's just ironic that we recognize the need to issue protective orders for businesses when elsewhere in this building we're having a difficult time mustering the support to issue protective orders for explicit photos of victims of rape and sexual assault. And that troubles me a little bit.
Thank you for the comment. Anything else? With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 609. Any reason why I shouldn't work the bill today? All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 609. Colleagues, discussion? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 609A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 609 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry this bill?
I'll carry this bill. And I will talk and I will talk only about the bill.
Representative Gelser will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 609.
Okay. I always strive to entertain on Tuesday mornings.
Thank you. It's appreciated. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 495. Dave, that's yours, huh? Okay.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. You have in front of you Senate Bill 495-A and -A3. Both of them are related to a property tax exemption or non-exemption of it, related to Pacific Northwest AC intertie to transmit power between the Pacific Northwest and California. So that bill, as amended in the Senate Bill 495A, grants property tax exemption to Oregon Electric co-ops to use a portion of the Pacific Northwest AC intertie. -A3 eliminates property tax exemption for an out-of-state city, or an out-of-state public entity of any intangible or tangible property rights, or property interest in or related to the Pacific Northwest AC intertie. So, -A grants the same property tax exemption that's enjoyed by out-of-state entities to Oregon co-ops. On the other hand, -A3 eliminates out-of-state entities from property tax exemption for the use of Pacific Northwest AC intertie. You have revenue and fiscal for -A, and you also have revenue and fiscal for -A3.
Thank you. Well, we have three people signed up to testify, all with different positions, so I'm going to call them all, and we'll see where they go. Sandy Flicker, Gil Riddell, John DeLorenzo. Oh, excuse me, there are two signed up under that. Let's hear from Sandy Flicker and Gil Riddell first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. There are 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon. Senate Bill 495 is a bill that was at the request of the rural electric co-ops. It is a bill that we believe is a tax equity bill. And I want to spend just a couple minutes giving you the history of this bill and why I am here today. In 2005, the legislature passed a bill, Senate Bill 31, that exempted three out-of-state utilities from paying a use tax on property for the third AC intertie line. At that time, the electric cooperatives, who also pay that use tax for the same use of that same line, asked to be considered for an exemption as well, because we were identically situated in terms of that line. We were not given an exemption. The three out-of-state utilities were given the exemption, and the electric cooperatives were not. So in 2007, we were back with a bill at the request of Representative Paul Holvey, House Bill 2793, to again request an exemption from this tax that other utilities who are identically situated were exempt from. The bill passed unanimously in the House and was not given a hearing in the Senate. So, hence, I'm back with Senate Bill 495. To once again ask the legislature to remedy an inequitable tax policy. Here today, I'm representing cooperatives that are members of an entity called Power Resources Cooperative. It is a regional entity. There are four Idaho co-ops and two Washington co-ops, and I think it's seven or nine Oregon co-ops that are part of Power Resources Cooperative, and they are the entity that pays this tax on this third AC intertie line. The amount of the tax is only about, I think it says $72,000, that is spread out among, I believe, 13 counties. So it is not about money. That is not a lot of money for us to pay, frankly, and it's not a lot of money for the counties to lose. So we don't believe it's about revenue impact on either side. We believe it's about equity. Customers in Oregon, electricity customers in Oregon, are being asked to pay a tax that customers in Washington are not being asked to pay. And so we believe that's discriminatory. We're giving favorable treatment to out-of-state utility customers over in-state utility customers. I know that there are other interests in this bill. At this point in time, I am here on behalf of Senate Bill 495A, and I am asking you to consider giving us equitable treatment in this tax policy. There are other interests, as I just stated, that Mr. Riddell will probably be speaking to you about. And so I think, you know, there's a decision to be made about a tax policy in Oregon at this point in time. So my interest is in making sure that electric cooperatives are treated fairly and equitably, and I would very much appreciate your support for doing that in Senate Bill 495. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Flicker, have you had a chance to look at the A3 amendments?
Yes, I have.
And do you have comments on this?
I would only say that, you know, our position is for equity for electric cooperatives in this particular issue. I think, as I said, there are other folks that have other issues with this, and I'm going to let them speak to those issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here in support of the Dash A3 amendments, which would not grant a new property tax exemption, but rather would remove a property tax exemption that's been on the books since 2003 and applies to only three entities. In 2001, Department of Revenue began assessing Seattle City Light, Tacoma Power, and Snohomish PUD on property they used in Oregon to transmit electricity. Transmission was under a capacity ownership agreement, which the Supreme Court had recently found was taxable as a result of a case brought by Sandy's clients. In 2005, the legislature granted an exemption of the taxes imposed on the three Washington entities, terminating an active appeal by them in the Oregon Tax Court being defended by Oregon Department of Justice and Revenue. The decisions, the reasons for the exemption given by proponents into the 05 legislature were included violation of the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution and possible retaliation by the state of Washington against Oregon. We're asking you now to, as the 2009 Legislative Assembly, to reimpose this tax. Washington and Oregon have parallel tax policies. Both states tax property owned or used by out-of-state public entities. Removing this particular exemption for out-of-state public entities follows the basic principle of taxation of non-exempt use of government-owned property, as reaffirmed by the Oregon Supreme Court. This is very common. Oregon need not give a competitive advantage to public entities in Washington that are in the business of marketing their power and sending it through this state. Nothing prevents the sellers from asking enough return from sales to cover their tax liabilities. With respect to the Commerce Clause argument, this is refuted by a recent opinion from Legislative Council, and that opinion is attached to my testimony. In terms of the retaliation by the state of Washington to Oregon for this legitimate tax, if you choose to reimpose it, if an Oregon entity, public entity, owns or uses property in Washington that would be taxed, if it was held by private interest, the Oregon public entity will be taxed there. I have two examples of Washington law that illustrate this differing treatment between in-state and out-of-state entities. A Washington state PUD is exempt from property tax but pays a PUD privilege tax based on volume sales. A publicly owned power company that is not chartered in Washington, however, will likely pay a leasehold excise tax, which is calculated on market rental of property used. In other words, it's an ad valorem tax. Second example of differing treatment, Washington statute provides that a specific exemption for government-owned property. That exemption, however, does not apply to property of municipal corporations from out of state. The Dash A3 amendments simply reapply property tax policy under which both states operate. Legislative Council notes that these three Washington entities receive Oregon services, such as maintenance of public ways, protection of public safety services, criminal laws, and the courts. Moreover, the tax would be assessable only to the extent of the entity's use of property located in Oregon. According to the latest tax expenditure report, this property tax exemption costs Oregon $1.2 million, education and public service money, during the biennium and shifts $200,000 of tax burden to other taxpayers. It benefits only out-of-state enterprises. There's no stated purpose for the exemption. If removed by legislative action, there will not be a tax increase on Oregonians. And a mere majority is all you need to correct this policy error of 2005, according to Legislative Council. Now is not the time to ignore legitimate, lawful, and reasonable opportunities to provide revenues for badly needed public services, and we urge your adoption. In the alternative, if you choose to pass this bill amended, then we urge you to follow the recommendation number 40 of the Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services and comply with the statutory promise to pay 50% of revenues lost to counties, special districts, and cities for this new property tax expenditure. As stated in the task force report, local governments bear the brunt of revenue losses when the state enacts new property tax breaks. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Call?
Yeah, Gil, can you just, I guess my one question is, I think you've given us good evidence here that if there was an Oregon company situated like this that was using an interchange in Washington or any other, you know, correlative situation, that they would be paying taxes in Washington. My question is there any Oregon municipality that is actually paying taxes to Washington?
Chair Representative Call, our Department of Revenue may know, but I do not know of any municipality in Oregon that is now conducting enterprise in Washington State that would fall under this. My only point is that if it did, it would be taxed.
To the best of your knowledge, while if it did, it would be taxed, if we were to do the Dash A3s, we would be, while under law there would be, seem to be an equity between the two states in their policies, what would actually be happening is that we would be exercising a unilateral taxation of three Washington municipalities.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Call, that is one way of looking at it. The other way is that we have three out-of-state municipalities that are doing business in Oregon, and none of the Oregon municipalities have taken advantage of that same situation. And if they did, they'd be taxed.
I'm fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I specifically asked Mr. Riddell to determine by some contacts in Washington if, in fact, we had identical situation with Oregon companies using an intertie, which they don't, by the way, through Washington, would Washington tax those Oregon companies? And would you tell them what you found out, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley, I had correspondence by email with the Utility Evaluation Supervisor, Washington Department of Revenue, and I'm glad to share this information, and if you wish to have it confirmed, then fine. I think that's a good idea. But I put this identical fact situation to him that we have here, knowing later that the AC intertie does not extend into Washington State, but putting the same situation. And his response, and I said this would be taxed on an ad valorem basis by Washington State, and his response was, that is my interpretation of the rules. But as Representative Riley points out, there is the AC intertie does not extend into Washington State. There are, however, public power lines in Washington State.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in either of your thoughts on why Oregon would exempt its municipalities, yet not those in another state. And I noticed that some of the material we've been provided, the case of Western States, apparently said this but didn't explain it. And can either of you venture a thought as to why we would exempt municipalities in Oregon but not those outside of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, let me just make one attempt at the answer, and I'm only going to respond to this particular issue. There are only six or seven contracts for the use of this line. There is not an Oregon municipal utility who has a contract to use this line. So there are only a small handful of entities, utilities, that use this third AC intertie line to transport power. So even though there are many other utilities in Oregon, only the co-ops through Power Resources Cooperative use that third AC intertie line. There are no other municipal or PUD utilities that use it. We use it exclusively on behalf of consumer-owned utilities.
My question had an assumption that may be incorrect. Do you think that if an Oregon municipality was using the intertie, it would be taxed? Or would it be exempt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't know that I can answer that with any certainty of being correct. I do believe that municipals do have tax exemptions for property taxes, and I would assume this would fall under that, but I would prefer the Department of Revenue to give you their answer because it may be more correct than mine, but that's what my belief is.
Yes, please.
Then just to follow up, then assuming both of our assumptions are correct, that an Oregon municipal organization would not be taxed, that takes us squarely back to the question, which why would we go ahead and tax a municipality that's just located outside our boundaries when we wouldn't tax one inside? That's really an interesting issue to me. So we can wait and listen to the Department of Revenue, perhaps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I have an answer, too. But I'm reading from the Legislative Council opinion that I've attached and the discussion of the Commerce Clause issue. And I do know from some brief reading on the subject, this is a very common practice in virtually all states to exempt their own public entities while not exempting others. But you'll see on page 3, the drafter quotes the Oregon Tax Court as concluding that exempting subdivisions of taxing states from state taxation is a matter of public policy. Such taxation is justified because imposing taxation would render necessary new taxes to meet the demand of this tax, and thus the public would be taxing itself in order to raise money to pay over to itself. No one would be benefited but the officers employed. I don't know if that answers your question. I just would say that this is very commonly found in state law.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John DiLorenzo, Gary Conklin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine and am here on behalf of my clients, the City of Seattle, the City of Tacoma, and the Snohomish PUD. Also with me today is Mr. Gary Conkling, who also represents these Washington municipalities and Washington municipal corporations. Although we have no position regarding Senate Bill 495A as printed, we vehemently oppose the -A3 amendments, which would have the effect of repealing an exemption from property tax for our contractual interests in the Pacific Northwest intertie. The cities of Seattle and Tacoma and Snohomish PUD generate and distribute electric power for our ratepayers. We are not profit-making entities. We operate not-for-profit. Seattle's department that generates and distributes electricity is called Seattle City Light. Tacoma's department is known as Tacoma Power. Neither Seattle nor Tacoma nor Snohomish PUD serve any customers in Oregon, nor do any of these entities own any real property within the state of Oregon. Our only contact with the state of Oregon is the contractual right to transmit electrons from Washington to California and from California back. I will not read my testimony from pages 1 through page 2, but there is a description as to how this intertie works. We've had occasion to speak with many of you about it. Essentially, California and Washington occupy sort of a yin and yang relationship when it comes to power supply. When Washington has excess hydropower,
California is quite typically in need when California has excess power. Washington is quite typically in need. And so the intertie assists us in balancing our power needs for the benefits of our ratepayers, not for profit. Although the Department of Revenue was aware in 1995 that our clients had intertie contracts with the Bonneville Power Administration, and by the way, most of those contracts related to advance purchase agreements. The Treasury at one point balked with respect to spending Treasury dollars from the United States for construction of the intertie, and so one of the ways to finance it was to obtain from customers advance payments for services. Those advance payments were then used to secure financing to then finance the intertie construction. So that's the type of contractual arrangement we have. The department found out about this probably after the PRC case, which Sandy Flicker mentioned, and attempted to assess retroactively the ratepayers of Seattle, Tacoma, and Snohomish approximately $5,600,000 for past years of property tax. Each challenged the department's assessment by filing for relief in the Oregon Tax Court. Part of the case centered around ORS 307.090, which Representative Benz has mentioned. That statute purports to exempt city property and property owned by municipal corporations in this state from property taxation altogether, which would mean that whether the interest was the intertie or Beaverton City Hall or Hillsborough City Hall, it wouldn't matter. Those organizations, if they're in the state of Oregon, do not pay property tax, period. The Department of Revenue attempted to tax Seattle, Tacoma, and Snohomish only because they were either municipalities, cities, or, in the case of Snohomish, a municipal corporation, as defined by Washington law, that they were located outside of the state of Oregon. When the 2005 legislation was adopted, the court had yet to decide the question of whether this disparate treatment of Oregon versus of Oregon cities versus out-of-state cities, Oregon municipalities, municipal corporations versus outside municipal corporations, constituted unlawful discrimination under the Commerce Clause to the United States Constitution. Had we prevailed on that issue, and the issue was never addressed because the 2005 legislation settled the case, had we prevailed on the issue, the tax court would have had two basic options. It would have had an equalized treatment. It could have equalized treatment by affording Seattle, Tacoma, and Snohomish the same benefits that in-state cities and in-state municipal corporations have, in other words, an exemption for all property, or it could have equalized treatment by eliminating the exemption in ORS 307.090, which would have then caused in-state cities to have to pay property tax altogether with respect to Beaverton City Hall or Hillsborough City Hall or the like. That tax court case could have created a crisis for Oregon cities and for the legislature. Now, although the case was set for trial in April of 2005 at the request of the parties, including the Department of Revenue, the case was postponed pending action by the 2005 legislature. And I've attached as Exhibit 1 to my testimony the letter from the tax court affirming that, that the tax court was going to wait to see what the 2005 legislature was going to do. Now, the bill that initially exempted Seattle and Tacoma from property tax for their interest in the intertie was House Bill 3454. The main arguments were that no local governments were dependent upon property tax paid by these cities because the taxes had never been paid. So there was no flow of earnings that they would be, revenue rather, that they'd be deprived of. Secondly, Washington did not tax intangible property interests. And third, there was no interest in inviting tax retaliation from the state of Washington. On May 12, 2005, the House passed 3454 by a vote of 48 to 10. And a copy of the House roll call that day is appended as Exhibit 2. Several of you who were in the legislature at the time voted for that bill. In the Senate, the exemption became part of Senate Bill 31, which was the Federal Tax Reconnect Bill. The exemption was refined to also include the Snohomish PUD. The bill did not provide a blanket exception from all property tax that an out-of-state entity might be obligated to pay for in-state property, but rather only covered circumstances
where the property interest was in the Pacific Northwest Intertie, the owner was a city or public entity of a state other than Oregon, and the city or public entity did not own fee title interest in any real estate in Oregon. Oregon co-ops were not included because they are not like Washington PUDs. Unlike Washington PUDs, they are not municipal corporations. Washington PUDs are municipal corporations under Washington law. And in addition, the Oregon co-ops own real estate in Oregon. That bill passed by a vote of 54-4, and the roll call is attached as Exhibit 3. Now, there have been several arguments that have been waged by the proponents of the Dash A3 amendments, and I would really like to address those. The first, circulated by one proponent from its law firm minimizes our Commerce Clause argument and cites to a recently decided U.S. Supreme Court case called Department of Revenue versus Davis. The Davis case involved a state that granted a tax credit, or I'm sorry, that did not tax municipal bond interest issued by Kentucky at the time, as the state of Kentucky, but did tax municipal bond interest from other states, municipal bonds. The Davis case does not apply to this matter because it only talks about what is called the market participant exception to the Commerce Clause. If a state like Oregon owns a rock quarry, Oregon is allowed to favor itself over out-of-state competitors because it is itself a market participant. In Kentucky, Kentucky was a market participant in the municipal bond business. But in this situation, Oregon has no interest in the intertie, nor do any of the counties that would share in any of the tax revenues. Neither Oregon nor any of the counties are market participants, and so the Davis case doesn't matter. And this is still an open question. But more troubling are the attempts by the proponents to advocate removal of these exemptions by suggesting that our neighbors to the north would likely do nothing about it. During the 2005 session, Representative Tom Butler, then the chair of this committee, recognized that an equally revenue-starved legislature to the north would consider beginning taxing activities of Oregon municipalities and other entities in response to imposing a tax on Washington municipalities. Representative Butler noted at the time that there was only $850,000 per biennium of recurring revenue associated with imposing the tax on Seattle, Tacoma, or Snohomish. And we've attached as Exhibit 4 a copy of the revenue impact at that time that shows that. Now, I note that the current revenue impact has upped that to $590,000 for this fiscal year and $610,000 for the next. But remember, that is split among 11 counties. So you're talking about 11 counties sharing maybe $590,000 this fiscal year. Representative Butler thought it would be poor policy for Oregon to ignite that type of tax war over the paltry sums that would be derived by the counties. Now, it doesn't take much imagination, Mr. Chair, to consider ways in which our cash-strapped neighbor to the north could impose more taxes impacting Oregon residents. First and foremost, Washington could eliminate the sales tax exemptions that apply to non-residents from states that have no sales tax. You know, if you and I purchase products in Washington, all we have to do is show our Oregon's driver's license. And because we don't have a sales tax, we don't pay it. Washington could very easily eliminate that exemption. Number two, there are three hydropower projects covering more than 100 river miles in the main stem of the Columbia, owned by the Douglas County PUD, the Chelan County PUD, and the Grant County PUD. These are known as the Mid-Sea projects. Portland General Electric has worked with these PUDs in building non-federal generating facilities, and in return has received low-cost power to meet its customer load. Washington does not impose any direct taxes on PGE's output contracts because Washington does not tax intangibles, period. The property tax is not imposed because of that exemption. Washington could carve an exception to that exemption and tax intangible property interests such as power output contracts, thereby increasing power costs to PGE ratepayers.
One that isn't listed on my laundry list of bullet points is something I found out this morning. EWEB is one of four joint owners of a 100 megawatt wind power project called the Harvest Wind Project in Goldendale, Washington. Portions of that project are financed with a $46 million bond offering by EWEB. However, the other portion is financed by a pre-purchase agreement, very much like the same contract we have for the intertie. Washington does not impose property tax on pre-purchase agreements because they are intangible contract interests. Washington legislators who are cash-strapped, who were upset about property tax being imposed on Washington municipalities, might very well and easily carve an exception to that and tax the intangible interests in that contract by EWEB. There's currently no public utility tax imposed by Washington on transporting property over Washington waters. Currently, interstate pipelines are not subject to Washington public utility tax. Washington could require natural gas pipeline companies to pay the public utility tax on the portion of their pipelines running through Washington, which would not inure to the benefit of Oregon natural gas customers. There is no Washington public utility tax on pipeline movement of petroleum products, which are motor vehicle or jet fuel. Much of the gasoline supply that is used by at least northern Oregon comes from those pipelines. Washington could easily impose a tax that would be ratable with respect to the extent to which the pipeline goes through the state of Washington. And the list goes on and on and on, and I haven't even covered all the bullet points in the testimony. Now, of course, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not advocate these types of taxes. However, once the type of parochialism advanced by the proponents of the A3 amendments are put in place, there is no ending to the types of responses that could come from the North. And all for $850,000 or $510,000 plus $610,000 split among 11 counties per year, all for that. We respectfully suggest that before this type of policy, which could potentially ignite cross-border responses, becomes a reality, your committee should at least devote more than an hour or so of deliberation to make sure it is doing the right thing. This type of decision in the waning weeks of the legislative session, respectfully, is not wise policy absent a thorough consideration of all of our cross-border relationships. I thank you for your time and attention that you've given me, and I urge you to not adopt the -A3 amendments or any similar amendments until you have had adequate time to thoroughly consider the consequences and the extent of all of our cross-border relationships. Mr. Cockley and I are available to answer any questions you may have, and I thank you very much again for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Brune, and then Representative Call.
Thank you. Two questions, actually three questions I would have. The first is, has there been any, not that you would raise the flag and maybe ask the question, but has there been any indications from any of your colleagues in the Washington legislature that suggest that they're talking about this, if this somehow, and I don't even know if it's been on the radar screen, so you talked a lot about here's what could happen, but has there been any conversations you're aware of that said they may do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, no. We are not aware of any such conversations, although I can tell you that many of these examples have come from our client.
Sure. And as a follow-up, if this were to pass, how much conversation, thought, or conversation has gone into your client's next recourse, which would be, I guess, to file suit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brune, that is certainly on the table, and my clients filed suit once over this. They are resolute about this, not only for the amount of money at stake, but for the principle. And it is my understanding that they would pursue this with all available means they had to establish what they feel is a response to a very unfair tax policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to be brief, given the hour. I'm just trying to understand the history here. So a case was before which court? Where did it get to before the legislation was enacted?
Mr. Chair and Representative Call, the case was in the Oregon Tax Court.
Oregon Tax Court. And was the Commerce Clause question before that court? Was that something at issue there? Does that court have jurisdiction to address that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the court does have jurisdiction to address that question. The matter was framed in the pleadings by agreement of all of the parties. There were a number of issues that were first decided in the published case that you may have seen concerning this matter from the tax court was on motions for cross-summary judgment. The court had first made a determination that the Department of Revenue could not fully utilize the omitted property statute. The court also interpreted what municipalities and cities in Oregon meant and then issued its order on summary judgment, which was published. The court, however, by agreement of all the parties, postponed consideration of the Commerce Clause issue until the legislation had been considered by the 2005 legislature. The feeling was that if the legislature was considering legislation to exempt these parties from paying property tax on the intertie, it would be a foolish use of judicial resources to resolve what would ultimately be merely a theoretical issue. And so the answer is it was on the table, it was primed for resolution, it had not yet been briefed because it was awaiting the 2005 legislation, which passed, case was then dismissed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Just on the last point, the foolish use of judicial resources point, since this is now before us for the second legislative session in a row, and the court could be the final arbiter of this discussion, should it choose to, I wonder whose resources are being used foolishly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I will not venture into a debate between the three branches of government. They all have their own perspectives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Call. Other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony today. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 495. Colleagues, my intention is to carry over until tomorrow, and I apologize now for the fact that we're going to be carrying over bills in today's that are already well scheduled because of the lateness of the term and the desire to get things finished if we possibly can. I'm going to carry over House Bill 3405, House Bill 2069. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 495. We passed out Senate Bill 609. I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 748. I need a little more information on that one. There are amendments pending to the House bill that we sent over to the Senate on this issue, and I want to learn a little more about that, so it's possible we won't hear that one. But for the sake of the time, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 748 until tomorrow. I don't expect action on House Bill 3472 because that issue is being dealt with in House Bill 3405. We'll reschedule Senate Bill 498 if it looks like the questions that we've asked can be dealt with on that. Paul, have I dealt with all of the bill, all of the issues? All right. And so the carryovers mean until tomorrow. And with that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Oh, no, I got texted.